and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. You know me, I'm your aptly named host. It's Friday, March 22nd. I very much hope that you were with me last week. Don't let me hear that you missed Gary Vaynerchuk. Gary shared insights and inspiration from his body of work and his book, The Thank You Economy. And Amy Sample Ward and I talked about kindness, criticism, and honest online conversations. This week, IRS sale in aisle 403B. Evan Giller, a founding member of the law firm of Giller and Calhoun, explains the IRS's 50% off the penalty sale for 403B retirement plans that are not in compliance. Many plans are not up to code, and this is the year to fix those problems. We'll talk about the common mistakes and what to do. Also, compensation clarity. Our regular legal contributors, Gene Takagi and Emily Chan of the Nonprofit and Exempt Organizations Law Group, answer these questions. How do you determine what's reasonable compensation for executives? What happens if comp is excessive? What's the automatic penalty that kicks in if you don't disclose benefits? Plus, we're going to do a board role play, and we'll see who chairs that meeting. This is from the Nonprofit Radio Vintage Collection. Last October was a very good month. Between the guests today on Tony's Take Two, my podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy that I do monthly, Fundraising Fundamentals, some details about that. My pleasure now to welcome Evan Giller. He's a founding member of the law firm of Giller and Calhoun. He's worked on employee benefit plan issues, including retirement and executive compensation plans, for over 20 years. He has extensive experience in plan design and compliance and is a contributing author to the 403B Answer Book. I'm very glad that his expertise brings him to the studio. Evan Giller, welcome.
Well, thank you, Tony, and very happy to be here.
Pleasure. We're all lawyers and compliance issues today, but I'm going to keep you all of you on the straight and narrow. Let's start very basic so that we know that everybody can figure out whether they have a 403B or they don't. What is a 403B plan?
Okay, so a 403B plan is a retirement plan that is only available to tax-exempt organizations, not-for-profit organizations, mm-hmm. or to governmental organizations that are educational organizations like K-12 public schools and state and local universities and colleges.
Okay.
So the reason that 403B is in the code is because those types of organizations were deemed to need a very simple, fairly cheap way of providing retirement benefits to their employees.
Now, a tax-exempt a charity could have, and our audience is the 501c3s, small and mid-sized charities. They could have some other kind of retirement plan for their employees. Is that
right?
Yes,
that's exactly correct. Until recently, well, when I say recently, probably about the last 20 years, these types of organizations could not have a 401k, but that's not true anymore. They can have a 401k as well, or what's known as a qualified 401a plan. And I will keep the jargon to a minimum.
Okay, yes.
As jargon jail. As I know.
Okay.
Is the rule. But that's a plan that, although it's under a different section of the code, looks kind of the same. It allows the employer to put in money on behalf of the employees, accumulate an amount that they can get when they retire.
Okay. So we have the 401ks, the 401as, but we're talking today about the 403bs. Okay. What is the problem with some, I think maybe lots of, 403B retirement plans?
Right. So if I can I give you a little history here?
Oh, please. Yeah.
So, and we could go back far into the depths of
not too far into the 1800s.
Right.
Let's stick to the 1900s.
Yes. Yes. But these plans were set up originally because it was perceived that college professors could not retire because they didn't have enough money to retire on, and so these plans were set up much like individual plans, sort of like IRAs today. Individual annuity contracts were issued to the participants in the plans, to the college professors. Ultimately, they were expanded to cover all 501c3s and these, you know, governmental educational organizations, and they were very lightly regulated for many years. And I should say that there are really two important regulators we're talking about. As you said, we're talking about the IRS. We're also talking about the Department of Labor. And the Department of Labor also regulates these plans. And in the last, since 1986 and on, both of these organizations have decided that the 403B world was too big too much like the Wild West, but too big, and needed to be increasingly regulated.
Okay, so the plans became popular, so popular that regulators got concerned about them.
That's right. They became large.
Yeah.
You know, with large tax exempts can have giant plans. And so the regulators did get concerned about them and wanted to make sure that they were being operated properly.
Okay, because the ultimate concern is that we want to have money for the retirees that are participating in these plans.
Exactly. And the other concern is that the IRS has all sorts of rules. These rules are the quid pro quo for the tax benefit that you get out of these plans. And the IRS wanted to make sure that these rules were being followed properly.
Okay. So rules are not being followed. And we have we'll get to this, but we have a period where you can save some money on penalties for not following the rules. But what's the main problem is the plans,
right? So
okay, I introduce it, but you talk us through it.
So the overarching issue here is that until 2009, under the IRS's rules, these plans weren't required to have a document. A written plan that they had to follow. And a lot of these plans didn't have anything, but they had very sketchy documents. Because actually, on the Department of Labor side, you were supposed to have a document as well, but nobody was looking too closely at it.
And this is a document that describes how your plan is going to operate.
Right. So the document is very often very detailed, and it says exactly how the plan is supposed to operate, and also contains all the IRS requirements. So in 2009, the IRS set a deadline that by January 1st, 2009, every 403B plan, with very narrow exceptions, had to have this written document.
Okay, this is the increased regulation that you were talking about.
Correct.
That we started to see. Okay,
right.
You had that January deadline.
Right.
January 2009 deadline.
Right.
Yeah.
And actually, in December of 2008, just as everybody was scrambling to complete this deadline, the IRS actually gave an extension to the end of 2009.
So that was a busy time for you.
It was a
And then you got an 11-month reprieve.
It was a fantastically exciting moment.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. You were able to enjoy your holidays year, in 2008, although it wasn't looking like you were going to.
Exactly.
Okay.
So
did they wait until December 31st?
No,
2008?
No, but it was close. It was in the first week in December.
It was. They gave you a month reprieve. Okay.
They liked suspense.
Yes.
Yeah. So but that deadline, the end of 2009, came and held. And so all 403B plans, again, there are some very narrow exceptions, had to have this written document adopted formally by the organization by December 31st, 2009. If you didn't do that, you're out of compliance. Your plan, theoretically, the plan could be deemed to be failed, a failed plan.
Okay.
Very bad result. A failed plan means that all the money in all of the contracts in that plan will be taxable.
The contracts are all your employees.
That's right.
Okay.
That's
so,
right.
So the danger of being out of compliance is what are your employees going to suffer?
They're going to have a very bad tax consequence. And they're going to look to you as the employer, and they're going to say, why did this happen? So the IRS doesn't like to invoke this nuclear penalty on plans very much.
Of disqualifying the plan.
Of disqualifying plans,
okay.
Right.
Okay.
And so for a number of years, they have worked on a program that allows plans, and not just 403B plans, but all kinds of retirement plans, to correct errors so that they don't get disqualified.
All right. So you were supposed to have had your plan document by December of 2009. But since then, they've been working to get people into compliance because they know there are a lot that didn't make that deadline.
That's right.
Okay.
And so they have said that to the extent that you have failed to adopt, that you failed to adopt your plan on time by that deadline, now at the end of last year, they came out with a program, the IRS did, that said you can submit a plan document to the IRS now, pay a penalty, and you will be absolved of having failed to meet the original deadline.
Yes, you're absolved. You're brought into the fold.
You
come to the flock. We will absolve you, but you have to pay a penalty.
You're deemed to be in compliance, but you have to pay a penalty.
Okay, okay.
And that gets us to the 50% off sale. So in 2013, if you have that one mistake, and you can have other mistakes, but if you have that one mistake,
failed to
adopt the plan document on time, and you go in through this program, the IRS is cutting the penalties in half for the course of the year.
There's your 50% off sale.
It's a sale.
Okay. We have just about a minute or so before we take a little break. What needs to be in? Well, first of all, you have to have your document, and then it has to be the document has to be correct. Is that right?
Well, actually, when you go through this program, the IRS is not going to give you an opinion as to whether the document is correct. That's another process that we can talk about. Here, the IRS just wants to see you have your organization has formally adopted the document.
Okay. Okay. All right. Why don't we take that break? And when we come back, Evan Giller stays with me. He's a founding member of the law firm of Giller and Calhoun, and we're talking about the IRS sale in aisle 403B. Stay with us.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Are you confused about which diet is right for you? Are you tired of being tired? How about improving your energy, strength, and appearance? Hi, I'm Rika Keck, a holistic nutrition and wellness consultant. If you have answered yes to any of my questions, contact me now at nyintegratedhealth.com or at 646-285-8588. Initiate change and transform your life.
Are you concerned about the future of your business or career? Would you like it all to just be better? Well, the way to do that is through better communication. And the best way to do that is training from the team at Improving Communications. This is Larry Sharp, host of the Ivory Tower Radio program and director at Improving Communications. Does your office need better leadership, customer service, sales, or maybe better writing or speaking skills? Could they be better at dealing with confrontation, conflicts, and touchy subjects? All are covered here at Improving Communications. If you're in the New York City area, stop by one of our public classes or get your human resources in touch with us. The website is improvingcommunications.com. That's improvingcommunications.com. Improve your professional environment. Be more effective. Be happier and make more money. Improving Communications. That's the answer.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
Welcome back. I wish I could send live listener love, but we are pre-recorded. It's a few weeks before March 22nd. So I can't send live listener love, but you know that we do love our live listeners. Evan, you and I are talking about, I'm going to introduce something to save you from jargon jail, because you probably wouldn't have said it this way. I like this. The VCP for EPCRS. Isn't that what we're talking about? The VCP for EPCRS?
We are, and I'm glad I didn't say that.
Yes, you wouldn't have, because practicing attorney or not, you know, jargon jail is open for you, and would have had quite an impact when the Board of Bar Examiners or the New York State Bar Association found out about your felony jargon jail. So I'm doing it. VCP for EPCRS. What does that mean?
Okay, so those are two acronyms that describe this correction program that we were talking about. So EPCRS is the acronym for the overarching program, the Employee Plan Compliance Resolution System.
Thank you. Yes.
So everybody wrote that down. But known affectionately as EPCRS to everybody. And VCP is one of the components of it, Voluntary Correction Program. And that's important. That one, though, is important to spend a little bit of time on what those words mean, because it means that you're turning yourself into the IRS. You have found an error, and you're turning yourself into the IRS to correct that error for a reduced amount of a fee, but it'll be lower than if they caught you.
Right, 50% lower.
Well, no, that's something else. So 50% is the sale on the VCP fee for this year for that non-compliance error that we talked about.
Okay,
but
yes,
in general,
the claim document.
Right,
yeah.
But forgetting about this year, forgetting about the 50% off. If the IRS catches you in a violation, it's going to cost you more than if you turn yourself in.
That's really?
That's the basic theory.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we know that the dangers if you haven't adopted your plan document, and I realize there are other things that could be wrong with your 403B, and we're going to have time to talk about those too. You have top five, Evan's top five. But so far now, we're just talking about not having adopted your plan document by the 2009 deadline. Your employees will face taxation. You'll be embarrassed. Your plan disqualified. There's penalties for that, of course, if the IRS finds it. Okay. So what do we do now if we haven't adopted our plan document? How do we enter this rehabilitation program?
So the IRS has come out with a kit, actually, a compliance kit, in the last 3 weeks or so, that takes you through all of the steps that you need to follow in order to get into this program and submit and get blessing.
And this, you're doing this as an outpatient, right? Inpatient rehabilitation.
Right. It's definitely out of it. You basically are, it's all by the mail. You know, you send in a document, there are a bunch of forms that you need to fill out.
Okay.
And sometimes, you know, you might find that they're kind of complicated. They're in IRS speak and you may want a little help. But basically, it's a set of forms that you send in with your document and proof that your plan has been adopted.
Okay. Now, what needs to be in this document? This plan, what are the parts? Yeah.
So a 403B document has to contain, at the very least, all of the requirements in that code section for a 403B plan. So what does that include? That includes limitations on contributions that the IRS requires. In other words, the IRS says you can't put in $1 zillion for some rich...
Meaning you, the employer.
You, the employer.
Limits on the contributions.
Right.
Okay.
And those of your listeners who are familiar with 403B plans know actually one of the most valuable and appealing aspects of it is salary reduction contributions by employees, where you put in money on a salary on a before tax basis into the plan, just like a 401k plan. and there are limits on that as well, and those are very strict limits
on how much an employee can put in.
Okay. Correct.
Okay.
Which in 2013 is $17,500.
Okay.
There are requirements that everybody in the organization has an opportunity to make those contributions on a before tax basis. It's called, and I know I may be skinning.
As long as you define your jargon,
I may be yes.
You're just skirting jargon, you won't be entered.
So it's called the universal availability rule, which means that, sounds that everybody in the organization, with again narrow exceptions, has to be allowed to make these contributions on a before tax basis. You can't pick and choose.
So this is who you invite to participate in your 403B plan.
Right. And you have to let them know that they've got that opportunity. You can't keep it a secret.
Okay.
And believe it or not, I've seen some cases where the employer hasn't told employees that they're able to do that.
Okay.
So there's that. There are requirements for taking money out of the plan. They're called minimum distribution requirements. When you get to be age 70 and a half, you have to take out a certain amount because the IRS really doesn't want you dying with that money to pass it on to the next generation.
Okay. Same age at which you have to start your mandatory required distributions for IRAs.
That's exactly right. It's the same rule.
Okay.
It's the same rule.
Okay.
There are other types of what are called non-discrimination rules. You can't give a lot of money to the top management and give a lot less money to the rank and file. Make contributions to the plan at a higher level to the top management versus the rank and file.
Okay.
So they're
non-discrimination.
Exactly.
Okay.
You can't discriminate in favor of highly compensated people.
Okay. Because this sounds like a very interesting... Now, you draft these documents, I imagine.
We do.
It's good that there are people who enjoy the details of this. It's interesting to me, but I don't have to write them. But what has to be in there is interesting. What other little pieces should be in there?
So one of the things, and this sort of bleeds over into, you know, things that can go wrong. I mean, one of the things that you want to put in this document is let's say your plan says the employer is going to make contributions on behalf of employees of 5% of compensation. That's a typical plan, or 10% of compensation.
Mm-hmm.
You need to define compensation very, very carefully. It's an area where there are a lot of errors. So some places don't want to include, let's say, bonuses. Some employers don't want to include bonuses. Some don't want to include overtime. In the school world, they don't want to pay perhaps coaches who get extra money for coaching. So there is a very... it's very easy to make an error in the way you write out your compensation definition, and then your plan is wrong. You're making contributions on the wrong definition of compensation.
Okay. And as you said earlier, the IRS is not passing on the correctness or the adequacy of your plan document under this correction plan, under this period that we have. They're just making sure that you have a plan adopted.
That's right. That under this very narrow piece that we're talking about. Now, if you find other errors, let's say you have the wrong definition of compensation. for instance. And you've discovered this. You can go in now. You can go in to VCP.
Okay.
And you can say, hey, we found a mistake. We want to correct it.
The voluntary correction program.
The voluntary correction program under EPCRS.
Yes.
And we don't, you know, we know we've made a mistake. We want to fix it. And we're going to fix it. And then you pay a fee and you tell the IRS, this is how we're going to fix it. Now, maybe you fix it by giving some people some additional money because your definition of compensation said that that you actually should have put in more money for them.
Okay, your definition was too low.
Right.
So there's added compensation, which means added contribution by the employer.
Correct. Okay. Right.
But now the fee that you pay, this is not eligible for the 50% off.
Correct.
It's only for adopting your plan.
That's right.
By, well...
Failing to adopt the plan and correcting it, failing to adopt it on time, which was December 31st, 2009. That's the only place where you got that little sale.
Okay, right. Let's see. Well, how long does this does VCP for the plan adoption correction? How long does that last? Is it just this year, or do we know, or what?
Well, VCP will be indefinite.
Okay.
VCP. The 50% is just this year, but the process of going into VCP, that's an indefinite program that will be open for a long time. And actually, there are other programs that the IRS are going to has said that they're going to introduce that will work with VCP that will affect 403B plans. Basically, this area is evolving.
Okay. Okay. What is this? You get 50% off the penalty. What is the penalty based on? How much is it?
The penalty is based on the size of the number of employees that you have in the plan. So there's a schedule, and it starts at the very low end. It's about $750 for really small plans.
It's a penalty.
Penalty. That's the let's call it the filing fee to go into VCP, but it's a penalty.
Yeah.
It goes all the way up to about $25,000 if you've got a giant plan of 10,000 employees or more.
Okay, so it's based on the number of employees in your plan is how much you'll pay for a filing fee, euphemistically a filing fee, but you'll get half off that if you're adopting your plan newly.
In 2013. Right, if you've missed the deadline and you do them this year.
Okay.
And that's your only issue. You know, if you're going in with two issues, you know, or three issues, you found, well, look, I made a couple of other mistakes, then that's full freight. But
You can't piggyback.
You can't piggyback.
You can't slide in getting the plan adoption and then add a couple in quietly.
You've got
other errors in quietly.
You know, Tony, you have to wake up pretty early in the morning to fool the IRS.
Well, so suppose you adopt your plan, get the 50% off on that, and then later on, 2 months later or 2 weeks later, then you found other errors in your plan.
You could do that, but actually there's no point because the way VCP works, and this is a good thing, you don't pay any more if you've got one error, with the exception of this half-off thing, you don't pay any more if you've got one error or 12 errors. So you may as well just get them all fixed.
Oh, so you'll still get the 50% off on the plan adoption but you'll pay full freight on the other.
Well, except that let's say if you go in, you fail to adopt, and you've got two other mistakes, you'll just pay.
I'm trying to game the system.
You are.
But I guess they've disappointingly, the IRS is a step ahead of me. That's kind of embarrassing.
To sort of sum it up, the only way you get the 50% off is if you go in with that one mistake that you failed to adopt the plan on time.
That one mistake.
That's the only way you get 50% off. If you're going with two mistakes, you're going to have to pay the whole thing.
Right. But what happens if you come in later with the second mistake?
Well, then you're paying one and a half times, right? You're paying the 50% and then you're paying a full fee. So why would you do that? You follow what I'm saying? So in other words, if you bifurcate it the way you're suggesting, then you're paying 50% now and then you're paying 100% later. If you do both together now, you're only paying 100%.
Oh, the penalty schedule is the same. For the different errors. Oh, I thought maybe there were different schedules for different types of errors. No, same.
They thought of that.
Okay. Yeah. Evan Giller is a founding member of the law firm of Giller, G-I-L-L-E-R, and Calhoun, C-A-L-H-O-U-N. You'll find them at GillerCalhoun.com. Sounds like you should be out in the Wild West. I don't know, Oklahoma or Wyoming. Just at Calhoun.
Calhoun happens to be based in Denver, so you're not that far off.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, so you have two offices. You're in New York and Denver. Okay. Let's spend time talking about some of the other errors that may be in your plan. You have top five, and I think we've alluded to some of them, but we'll make them explicit. Let's just get started. What's the most common error that you see in 403B plans?
Okay. So, you know, The most common error that we see, again, without getting too deep into the weeds on this.
Don't worry, I'll stop you.
You'll stop,
you
right, okay.
Yeah. I'll get lost, and then I won't let you lose others.
I said earlier that there are two regulators. One is the IRS, one is the Department of Labor. And the Department of Labor is those people who are at all involved with retirement plans will know the dreaded ERISA word. ERISA is the statute that governs employee benefit
E-R-I-S-A.
Plans. E-R-I-S-A.
Employee Retirement Income Security Act?
Very, excellent.
Is it? Okay,
yeah, yeah.
Okay.
The most common error that we find actually is an ERISA error and not an Internal Revenue Code error. And it's worth mentioning because it's a common error and it's a serious error.
Okay.
And that is if you have a plan that allows employees to put money in on an elective deferral, a salary reduction basis, before tax basis, like mm-hmm. we were talking about before, mm-hmm. You have an obligation to send that money to the insurance company or the mutual fund, if you're using mutual funds, very quickly. You can't sit on that money and let it sit in your bank account and say, you know, I'll get to it in a couple of weeks.
Oh, really? Even a couple of weeks is too long?
Yes, a couple of weeks will almost always be too long. In this day and age of automatic payroll systems, the Department of Labor thinks that 2 weeks is almost, you could almost never justify it.
Okay.
So what happens is that people get a little careless sometimes, and maybe the payroll person goes on vacation, or their processes aren't in place, and the money sits there. And the Department of Labor thinks that's a bad violation. They want that money going in quickly, because when the money doesn't go in quickly, it doesn't experience investment return. It's sitting in your bank account, and you're theoretically getting interest on it.
Yes.
As an employer. So the DOL doesn't like that. You need to be very vigilant about getting that money to your insurance company or mutual fund.
What if now we're talking about the United States Department of Labor?
We are.
Right.
Okay. We are.
What if just like you mentioned, your payroll person goes on vacation one time. You were slow because the payroll person was on vacation, and when he or she came back, they caught the mistake. But it's been the 2 week vacation because they went they went exotic, maybe South Asia or something. It took it to a full week vacation. Now they're back. They realize the mistake. It's only one time. Is this a big deal?
Well, it's a great question on a couple of levels. One is we didn't talk about this. I mean, there is we talked a lot about filing with the IRS and the fee and through the VCP. In fact, when you have small violations on the IRS side, there's something called self-correction, where you don't have to file. Violations that fit within their self-correction program can just be fixed without filing. And it means you don't have to go in, you don't need their approval, you don't need to pay them anything, you just fix them. And that's to a certain extent true with the Department of Labor too. In that case, I would not call it a big deal, but I would say that if you found it, you should fix it.
Okay.
Fix it basically means giving the interest that the participants lost in the period of time that the person was on vacation, that 2 weeks.
Yes.
It's going to be a tiny amount of money, 2 weeks of interest on one contribution.
Still, you got to give it to them.
Do it.
Okay. Let's hit another couple. We have just a couple minutes left. Most common errors.
So another error is, and this also goes to what needs to be in the plan, there are these limits that the IRS imposes upon these plans about how much money can go in a year.
Right. You had mentioned this earlier.
And there are two separate limits. They kind of work together, but there's one limit that's the total amount that can go in as an employer contribution and an employee contribution. And then there's a separate limit that can go in as an employee contribution. That's the $17,500 we talked about.
Right.
The total limit is $51,000, oversimplifying a little bit, per year.
Okay. And I'm guessing that the error is miscalculation.
Correct. The error is miscalculation.
Okay.
And then there's also a limit on the amount of money of salary that you can take into account in doing the calculation. So in other words, if you say 10% of compensation, you can't consider any amount of compensation above $255,000. So if I'm making $500,000 because I'm the executive director.
Right.
Almost half of that can't be included in my contribution.
Okay. We have time for just one more. Top five.
So, excuse me. So another issue is this minimum distribution issue. I'm going to actually go to another one, which I think is probably more important.
Okay.
Which is loans and hardships. Many of these plans allow participants to take loans. and they you can take a loan out of your own account.
Oh, okay.
And you have to pay it back. You generally have to pay it back over 5 years, a little longer if it's to buy a house. Or a hardship distribution, which is if you have something really bad happen to you within the rules of the IRS, what the IRS considers to be really bad, including medical expenses within a certain limits. If you have a casualty loss, if Hurricane Sandy was a good example, if your house blows down.
And what's the trouble with these hardship distributions?
They're not, so the rules for the loans and the hardships are actually quite complicated, and they are often not applied correctly.
Okay. We can correct these, though, all through VCP, the Voluntary Correction Program, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Evan Giller, founding member of the law firm Giller & Calhoun at GillerCalhoun.com. Evan, thank you very much for explaining this and being a guest.
It was my pleasure.
Pleasure to have you. Thank you. Right now, we go away, and when we come back, Tony's Take Two, and then Compensation Clarity with Gene Takagi and Emily Chan. Stay with me.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
Hi, I'm Austin Marola.
And I'm Sloan Wainwright.
We're the hosts of the new Thursday morning show, The Music
Power Hour.
At 11 a.m.
We're going to have fun.
And shine the light on all aspects of music.
And its limitless healing possibilities.
We're going to invite artists to share their songs and play live.
We'll be listening and talking about great music from yesterday to today.
So you're invited to share in our musical conversation.
Your ears will be delighted with the sound of music.
And our voices. Join Austin.
And Sloan.
Live Thursdays at 11 a.m. on TalkingAlternative.com.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Lively conversation.
Top trends.
Sound advice.
That's Tony Martinetti.
Yeah, that's Tony Martinetti.
Nonprofit radio. And I'm Travis Frazier from United Way of New York City.
And I'm Michelle Walsh from the U.S. Fund for UNICEF.
Welcome back. Time for Tony's Take Two. Again, we're pre-recorded this week, so I can't send live listener love. I feel bad about that. I could guess a couple. I'm sure we have listeners from China. Ni hao. And where else? We certainly have listeners from Tokyo. I'll bet there are live listeners from Tokyo. And I forgot how to konnichiwa. Konnichiwa for our listeners in Japan. And Taiwan. Excuse me. I bet Taiwan is out there also. Where in the U.S.? North Carolina. California, New Jersey, New York, I hope. I'll bet you're out there. I'll bet you're out there. Tony's Take Two this week. I want to just remind you that I host a monthly podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy, and that is called Fundraising Fundamentals. And this month, I talked to consultant Rosetta Thurman about the cycle in charities that causes fundraisers to be dissatisfied with their work and CEOs to be dissatisfied with their fundraisers, which leads fundraisers to bail out of jobs, all to the detriment of charitable missions. Now, I talk with Rosetta about the causes and what fundraisers can do to break the cycle. And that's on Fundraising Fundamentals. You'll find it on the Chronicle of Philanthropy website. You'll also find it on iTunes. And there are links on my blog at tonymartinetti.com. And that is Tony's Take Two for Friday, the 22nd of March, 12th show of the year. I now have a vintage version of Nonprofit Radio. This is Compensation Clarity with Gene Takagi and Emily Chan. Right now we have Gene Takagi and Emily Chan on the line. We have them, don't we? Both? Excellent. Gene is principal of NEO, the nonprofit and exempt organizations law group in San Francisco. He edits the popular blog at nonprofitlawblog.com, and he's at GTAK, G-T-A-K, on Twitter. Emily Chan is an attorney at NEO, and she's principal contributor to the Nonprofit Law Blog. She is the American Bar Association's 2012 Outstanding Young Nonprofit Lawyer, and you can follow Emily at Emily Chan, at Emily, C-H-A-N. Emily and Gene, welcome back.
Hi, Tony.
Hi, Tony.
Good to have you back. We're talking this month about compensation, because it seems to flow from what Emily and I talked about just a couple of weeks ago. So, Emily, why don't you lead us into this from last month?
Sure. So, our last show, we talked about the private benefit rule. And at the end, I squeezed in a very big phrase there, the rebuttable presumption of reasonableness, and we're going to get into that in this show. But basically, we're going to look at the penalty that the IRS usually will impose when they find an inappropriate benefit going to an insider, as we talked about last week.
Okay.
So now we're really looking at, I guess, practically speaking, the kind of penalties that organizations should be very knowledgeable about and also very wary of, so that they can follow the best practices and make sure they're protecting their organizations.
All right. You were cutting out a little bit, Emily, but we were able to fix the sound quality. Just say very rich and wordy phrase again from last month that we'll talk more about. Just say that again because you cut out a little bit there.
Rebuttable presumption of reasonableness.
Rebuttable presumption of reasonableness. All right. We look forward to getting into that. Gene, what are the general guidelines for compensation and who are we talking about? Whose compensation are we talking about, and what are those general rules?
Well, practically speaking, we're talking about the compensation of the executives. So that would be the executive director or CEO or president, and of the CFO or treasurer if the organization has a compensated chief financial officer.
Okay. And what are the rules generally? That it has to be fair and not excessive?
That's practically the rule, Tony. So it can't be excessive, and the way we try to judge that is we try to look at what comparable organizations are paying. And so the big question is, what is a comparable organization and what is a comparable position to compare, you know, who we want to pay to another organization and what they're paying?
Let me throw something interesting, at least interesting to me. I don't know, maybe you heady legal minds may not find it interesting, but I do over here. You said it's only for executives, but what I see in a lot at colleges and universities, the highest paid people there are often coaches, sports coaches, like a basketball or football coach at a big you know, a big name program. Does excessive compensation apply to them also, or only to the executives of the organization?
That's a great question, Tony.
Oh, thank you. We'll bring you back next month.
Really,
thank you, Gene. It's
an interesting area. When we're talking about big institutions like colleges and universities and healthcare systems and big nonprofit hospitals, the range of what we call disqualified persons or insiders definitely goes up to people who have substantial influence over the organization or a particular segment of that organization. So football coaches will probably be drawn into that equation when they have a huge influence on the institution itself.
Okay.
There are just more general rules besides the what we call the intermediate sanction rules or excess benefit transaction rules, and I know I go into jargon jail for that.
Oh, my God, yeah. All right, we're going to get to that stuff.
Yeah, penalties and broader doctrines that you can get in trouble for as well.
Okay, broader than just the executive. So it's those who can exercise a lot of control over the organization, wherever they are in the hierarchy.
That's a good way to think of it.
Okay, cool. That's the layperson. I'm an attorney, but I don't even you wouldn't know it the way I talk. Okay, let's see. What is this intermediate sanction, Emily? Intermediate to what? What's the more extreme?
So the more extreme penalty comes from the rules we talked about last month with private benefit and private endowment, where technically, really the penalty is revocation of tax-exempt status. And that seems pretty severe, especially if the benefit confirmed was only a little bit more than what it should have been. So what the IRS produced then was something that they called their intermediate sanctions, also the excess benefit transaction rule, which instead of revocating tax-exempt status, they'll actually impose a penalty tax on that excess benefit. So it can be imposed both on the insider who benefited, and it usually starts with a 25% penalty tax of the excess amount, but also board members should know that they can also be taxed 10% of the excess amount if they knowingly approve the transaction.
Okay, knowingly meaning, and let's just stick with compensation at this point. Let's not get to the excessive benefits. We're just talking about direct compensation, cash compensation. So board members who knowingly approved it, meaning they knew that it was excessive?
Right. So they had actual knowledge of the transaction. And when I use the term excess benefit, I don't mean the stuff on top of, let's say, a base salary, just an excess benefit itself, which could be a large compensation amount.
Okay.
That's just the way that I use that term and the way that's used with the rule. So a board member who would be considered knowingly approving such a transaction would be someone who knows the terms of the transaction, also aware of the possibility that that transaction might be excessive in violation of this excess benefit transaction rule. And also, you know, failing to make those reasonable attempts to figure out whether it is actually excessive. So this goes back to the fiduciary duties of directors and making sure that they're meeting their duty of care as well as their duty of loyalty and making sure that they're making informed decisions and that it is in the best interest of the organization by not paying something that's excessive.
Okay. And we have talked about those duties, those fiduciary duties previously. Can these penalties that are levied against board members, can they be paid by the organization?
Generally, no. So this would actually be triggered under state law. There are provisions that have to do with indemnification, which is the organization's ability to cover expenses that would come out of situations like this or being sued in your capacity as like an officer or director of the organization. And generally, that's probably not going to be okay under state law, no matter what state you're
okay.
in.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, Gene, let's turn to you and let's talk a little about the rebuttable presumption of reasonableness that Emily mentioned before. What's that? How does that play in here?
So these procedures are useful wherever you know where you know that you're going to compensate one of these insiders an amount that is not obviously way below market level, but you should go through these procedures just as a general rule anyway if you're anywhere near paying market rate compensation. And there are three steps. The first step is getting advance approval by the board of directors before you enter into that compensation transaction. After the interested party, if there's an interested director in there who's going to be compensated, abstains from that vote and does not participate in that decision.
Okay, and that would include an executive officer who's on the board because of that position, that ex officio board member. They should abstain as well.
Absolutely.
If we're talking about their compensation, right?
Right.
Okay, so you get the advance approval with the abstention of the person who's involved. What
step
else?
Step two is reliance on appropriate comparability data. So we're looking at comparable salaries from similarly situated organizations for similar positions and similar work. So it's all about getting the right comparables, which might be done through salary surveys, working with professionals that are salary experts in the nonprofit area, or maybe looking at Form 990s. There are some different concerns about just taking other organizations' Form 990s to make sure they're the right comparables, but a lot of smaller organizations do it that way.
What are those? Well, before we go on, what are those concerns about using the 990?
Well, they might not reflect in the 990 special payments and vesting of, like, deferred compensation. So some organizations may look like they're paying a really high salary, but those are just a result of past things that have been obligations that were paid in the reporting year. So you can't really consider that as part of the annual salary, for example, of that executive that's showing on the 990. So that would not be a good comparable to use.
Okay. So I mean, can a small charity avoid having to hire a compensation expert to do these comparability surveys? What are the other ways? Or maybe there is no other way.
Well, there are some compensation surveys that are out there for free as well. You can find things from Charity Navigator, and I believe GuideStar might have some compensation surveys that are available for free. You have to be careful, though, because sometimes the ranges of the size of the organization don't play in your favor. So, you know, they may say, well, this is the average compensation for organizations with annual budgets between $1 million and $10 million. And depending upon where you fit in that structure, using the average may not be appropriate for your organization.
Right. Okay. Okay. And then
just to add a couple more things to the comparability data, because you brought up small organizations, a general rule of thumb is for organizations with less than $1 million in gross receipts to have at least three comparables. So it's not necessarily this, you know, widespread search for comparability data, but to have three is generally considered reasonable. And another thing to consider is this really is just giving you an idea of the bandwidth of salary that's out there, but it would be problematic for an organization to just look based purely on numbers and decide, okay, just because it fits in the bandwidth, that's appropriate. And that kind of goes back to your example of the football coaches, where sometimes it's just so skewed that if you keep pushing the upper limits of the bandwidth, you just start to see these ranges move up and up. And you really do need to look at the performance and the duties that are being asked of and things like that.
Yes, okay. Of course, the person's performance as well, not just what other people are paying somebody similar in a similar organization. Okay, thanks, Emily.
And one more thing, Tony, as well. Look at the geography, because I know in Manhattan and San Francisco, where we are, the average salaries are going to be much higher than somewhere in Des Moines, Iowa.
Yeah, okay. Okay, and there's one more part to the rebuttable presumption. Can you explain that in about a minute, Gene?
Yeah, the third part is just timely and adequate documentation of the board action. So that means really putting it down in the minutes and getting those minutes approved by the next board meeting. So you just want to make sure that you've documented it. And if you've got comparables, attach the comparables to the minutes to prove that the board has actually looked at these before making that determination and approval.
All right, now that we've explained the three prongs of the rebuttable presumption, Gene, please explain what the hell a rebuttable presumption is.
That's great. What it does is it shifts the burden from your organization to have to prove that the salary is reasonable and shifts it to the IRS to prove that it's unreasonable, which the IRS doesn't want to do because that takes a lot of work. So if you just go through these procedures, you've kind of put a big barrier to the IRS to go after you for paying excessive amounts, because you say, I've used the procedures that the Treasury regulations have approved. This is the way it should be done, and the IRS is usually going to back off at that point unless they think they have a really big fight there.
So then, right, if you follow these procedures, the compensation is presumed to be reasonable, but the IRS has the option, although it's unlikely that it would exercise it, to rebut that presumption and try to prove that the compensation was unreasonable. Is that right?
If they want to take it to court.
If they were, again, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not likely.
Okay, but it's presumed reasonable if you follow the three prongs that you laid out.
Correct.
Okay. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Gene and Emily and I are going to do a little role play exercise. We're going to be the board of directors, and we are going to decide on somebody's compensation. I don't know. One of you two is going to chair the meeting, so you're welcome over this break to figure out who that's going to be, and I'm going to be a board member. And then the other person will be a board member, too. So stay with us for that role play exercise. I don't know what's going to happen. Hope you'll stay with us.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
Have you ever considered consulting a roadmap when you feel you need help getting to your destination? When the normal path seems blocked, a little help can come in handy when choosing an alternate route. Your natal chart is a map of your potentials. It addresses relationships, finance, business, health, and above all, creativity. Current planetary cycles can either support or challenge your objectives. I'm Montgomery Taylor. If you would like to explore the help of a private astrological reading, please contact me at Monty@MontyTaylor.com. That's Monty, M-O-N-T-Y, at MontyTaylor.com.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
I got more live listener love. Laurel, Maryland, Bend, Oregon, and Tokyo. Welcome to our second listener in Tokyo. We got more Tokyo listeners than we have Oregon or South Carolina or North Carolina listeners. More in Tokyo than most other states listening. Okay, Gene and Emily, we're talking about compensation clarity, and we're going to do our role play board meeting now. Who's the chair?
I'm the chair, Tony.
Okay, Gene is the chair. Emily, you and I are board members, or are we just regular board members, or is one of our compensation under discussion, or what?
I think we're both board members.
Okay, but neither of us has our compensation under consideration?
No, we removed that person from the room.
That person's removed, okay. Yeah. All right, go ahead, Gene, you're going to chair the meeting.
Okay, Tony, so right now we're talking about approving the compensation of a candidate who's going to be our executive director.
Well, wait a minute, we didn't approve last month's meeting minutes. We didn't approve last month's minutes.
We had a consent agenda earlier, Tony, and now we're on the second part of our meeting.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
Okay, so
I'm taking my fiduciary duty very seriously. I want you to recognize this.
I appreciate that. That's awesome.
Care, loyalty, and what's my third fiduciary duty besides care and loyalty?
A lot of people like to say obedience.
Obedience. Okay. All right. Well, maybe I'm failing on three, but I'm taking my first two very seriously. All right. Go ahead. Emily obviously doesn't care, but she's a lackluster. Let me see, lackluster board member. I hope your term is up soon, Emily. All right.
Okay. So we've got an executive director that we need to hire, and this executive director is pushing us for a salary of $100,000 and the possibility of bonuses of up to $20,000.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
We've got $1 million in our budget, and we're not really sure whether to approve this compensation or not. He looks like a great candidate, but there's some other candidates out there as well. What do you think, Tony? Should we hire this person at the salary they're asking for?
Well, do we have any comparable data by organizations that are similar to ours, both in geographics and also annual budget? And would that data also be comparable in terms of this person's responsibilities?
Emily, I think you were collecting this data.
Yeah, so I researched some organizations that are of similar type, similar size, and similar roles of executive directors, and I found three different data points. So one, and these are all in our geographical area, one is 80,000, one reports 90,000, and another one reports 110,000.
Okay, and we're looking at 100,000 with the possibility of a $20,000 bonus. What do you think, Tony?
I guess the base sounds, so we have 80, 90, first of all, I'm assuming that Emily knows what she's doing when she says that these things are similar, and I'm putting a lot of faith in her because I could be personally liable if this turns out to be excessive compensation.
Only if you know that it's excessive, Tony. So that's a high standard.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
That does raise a good point about reliance, which you do need a reliable source in order to rely on it.
So. Okay. Well, you're an outstanding young lawyer, so I'll assume that that you're on the board.
I have experience doing this.
Yes.
I found some surveys, which I've brought to the board meeting, and we're going to attach them to the minutes at the end.
Okay. I like the base of 100. I'm not sure about the extra bonus of 20.
Emily, what do you think about that extra bonus of 20 when the high of our comparables is only 110?
I don't think it's necessarily problematic if we have adequate justification for allowing that. For example, if this opportunity with this executive director is probably going to pass us by, we are in a bind because we're now doing an executive director succession that we didn't anticipate, and the organization's going to be really hurt if we don't find somebody who's qualified, and this is the most qualified person we found, and we're actually getting a really good deal for this person. And it is discretionary, so it's going to be up to the board at the end of the year, and we have put a limit on it. You know, maybe we should evaluate again, looking at our revenues and looking again at the comparability data, whether 20,000 is reasonable, but I'm not opposed to putting the opportunity of a bonus into the contract right now.
That's a bunch of malarkey. I'm walking out of this meeting.
So that's your stuff, honey.
Did you hear me? Did you hear my footsteps?
So,
and I just slammed the door closed.
Here's what I'll propose. I'll ask to see if there's a motion to approve a $100,000 base salary with a possibility of a $10,000 bonus. And we will actually look at the possibility of a further $10,000 bonus if we hit certain revenue goals that might allow us to look at other comparables. Do you think that's reasonable?
All right, I'll come back into the meeting. All right, I'll go along with that. We have to wrap up our meeting very quickly. Yes, I would approve that.
Okay, so Emily makes the motion. Tony will second. We're approved. We've
but
got it done.
As we wrap this up, and being the diligent board member I am, just a reminder that we need to have adequate documentation in our board minutes. So I'm going to write down the terms of the transaction we approved, the date it was approved, the board members that were present during the debate and who voted. I'm also going to attach the comparability data on there, and as well as document the fact that we followed our conflict of interest policy and removed the executive director from the conversation.
That was Emily Chan. She's an attorney at NEO, the Nonprofit and Exempt Organizations Law Group. And our board chair was Gene Takagi. He's the principal of NEO. You'll find them both blogging at nonprofitlawblog.com. Gene and Emily, thank you very much.
Much thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Tony.
My pleasure. Thanks to my guests this week, Evan Giller and Emily Chan and Gene Takagi. Next week, as I said, I'm recording this show weeks in advance, so you'll, I don't know what's going to be on here the 29th completely, but have I ever let you down? I have not. So hopefully you don't think I have let you down. I do know Scott Kegler will be with me on March 29th. You can count on that. Good old Scotty will be here. He's our technology contributor and the editor of Nonprofit Technology News. What's he going to talk about? The man is only human. I can't ask him this many weeks in advance. But has Scott Kegler ever let you down? We're all over the social web. You can't make a click without Spacca La Testa smacking your head into Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. iTunes, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn, Foursquare, Pinterest, SlideShare, Facebook. Have you been to the Facebook page lately? If you love the show, please like the Facebook page, and more of our information will get into your newsfeed. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is our line producer, and the assistant producer is Janice Taylor. The show's social media is by Regina Walton of Organic Social Media, and the remote producer of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio is John Federico of The New Rules. Oh, I hope you will be with me next Friday, 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern, on Talking Alternative Broadcasting at talkingalternative.com.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Hi, I'm Dana.
And I'm Don.
We are certified mediators, and I am a family and couples licensed therapist and author of Please Don't Buy Me Ice Cream.
Our show, New Beginnings, is about helping you and your family recover financially and emotionally and start the beginning of your life.
We'll answer your questions on divorce, family court, co-parenting, personal development, new relationships, blending families, and more.
Dana and I will bring you to a place of empowerment and belief that even though marriages may end, families are forever.
Join us every Monday starting September 10th at 10 a.m. on TalkingAlternative.com.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
This is Tony Martinetti, the aptly named host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Technology, fundraising, compliance, social media. Small and medium nonprofits have needs in all these areas. My guests are expert in all these areas and more. Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, Fridays, 1 to 2 Eastern on Talking Alternative Broadcasting.
Are you fed up with talking points rhetoric? Every way you turn, it's left or right spin, ideology, no reality. In fact, it's ideology over intellect. No more. It's time for the truth. Join me, Larry Sharp, a.k.a. The Neosage, Tuesday nights, 9 to 11 Eastern, for the Ivory Tower radio program. In the Ivory Tower, we'll discuss what's important to you, society, politics, business, and family. It's provocative talk for the realist and the skeptic who want to know what's really going on, what does it mean, and what can be done about it. So gain special access to the Ivory Tower and listen to me, Larry Sharp, your Neosage, Tuesday nights, 9 to 11 New York time. Go to ivorytowerradio.com for details. That's ivorytowerradio.com. The Ivory Tower is a great place to visit for both entertainment and education. Listen in Tuesday nights, 9 to 11. It will make you smarter.
TalkingAlternative.com.